Maybe we should be welcoming them with open arms instead of making their lives miserable. Because immigration is good for us.
Without immigration, America's economic growth would have been 15% lower in recent years. Britain's would have been 20% lower, and Southern Europe's would have been 30% lower. If we were to deport all 12 million undocumented immigrants in this country, the economy would lose $8 trillion over the next 14 years. However, if we were to legalize all of them, the economy would gain $2 trillion in that same time period.
That's Suketu Mehta. We talk with him about his powerful book, This Land is Our Land, an Immigrant Manifesto. Then we speak with researcher Lou Daly about his report on some of the false solutions being proposed in the green energy space. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. There are few subjects in American life that prompt more discussion and controversy than immigration. But do we really understand it? In his book, This Land is Our Land, the renowned author Suketu Mehta attacks the issue head-on. Drawing on his own experience as an Indian-born teenager growing up in New York City and on years of reporting around the world, Mehta subjects the worldwide anti-immigrant backlash to withering scrutiny. As he explains, the West is being destroyed not by immigrants, but by the fear of immigrants. Mehta juxtaposes the phony narratives of right-wing ideologues with the ordinary heroism of laborers, nannies, and others from Dubai to Queens, and explains why more people are on the move today than ever before. He also demonstrates that immigrants bring great benefits, enabling countries and communities to flourish. Impassioned, rigorous, and richly stocked with memorable stories and characters, This Land is Our Land is a timely and necessary intervention in our understanding of this critical issue. Suketu Mehta is the author of Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His work has been published in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, National Geographic, and elsewhere. He's Associate Professor of Journalism at New York University. Suketu Mehta, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, This Land is Our Land, an Immigrant Manifesto, is so powerfully written and cogently argued. You say on the first page, quote, "These days, a great many people in the rich countries complain loudly about migration from the poor ones, but as the migrants see it, the game was rigged." How was the game rigged?
Well, my book begins with a story that my grandfather once told me. And my grandfather was born in India when it was still a British colony. And then he moved to Kenya when Kenya was also a British colony. And then he worked all his life for a Scottish trading firm. And then he retired in England. So one day in the 1990s, my grandfather was sitting in a park in London, minding his own business, and this elderly British gent comes up to him and wags a finger in his face and he says, "Why are you here? Why don't you go back to your country?" And my grandfather responded, "We are the creditors. You came to my country. You took all my gold and my diamonds. So we have come to collect. We are here because you were there." So when he told me this story, it seemed to me, an apt summary of why people have been moving from the poor to the rich countries, from the formerly colonized countries to the colonizers. When the British first came to India at the beginning of the 18th century, India produced a quarter of the world's GDP. By the time the British left in 1947, India's share of world GDP was under 4%. So all that money went to England. So when I walk around London and I see the palaces and the museums, I think I should have a room there. So there's a lot of complaints now in the rich countries about all these migrants coming from the poor countries. But the game was rigged through colonialism. Then what replaced colonialism, which is corporate colonialism, and the wars that the rich countries imposed on the poor ones, and climate change, which was largely caused by the rich countries. So people are moving all across the world, not because they hate their homelands or their language or their food, or most importantly, their families. They're moving because the rich countries have left them no choice. They are coming here because we were there first.
You, in fact, quote, I think, Mike Davis in calling what happened to India the late Victorian Holocaust. I mean, just the price of colonialism in these countries is really shocked me, even though I knew about it and I've known about it for years. But as you say, you know, dropping from, you know, a nice chunk of the world's wealth to 4%, this is not just India. This was something that was repeated, you know, with China. And today, you know, I was surprised you talk about the country of Guinea, whose population lives in extreme poverty, but it has a quarter to half of the world's bauxite reserves, gold and diamonds. We're talking about trillions of dollars a year in transfers of wealth that are still happening from the poor to the rich countries. So, you know, let's just dive in. Talk about neocolonialism today, or corporate colonialism.
So I did a lot of research for my book, and there are figures which are absolutely staggering, but I've provided some 50 pages of footnotes for readers. So anyone who wants to know where I've gotten my figures from can just go to the back of the book. And then I hired a professional fact checker to go over every line and challenge me on my assertions. And then parts of the book have appeared in magazines like Foreign Policy, where they've gone through another layer of fact-checking. But the facts themselves are absolutely astonishing. So the amount of silver that was shipped between 1503 to the early 1800s, the amount of silver that was shipped between Latin America and Europe, would amount to a debt of $165 trillion that Europe owes Latin America today. You're talking about Guinea. Yes, it has up to half the world's bauxite, but there's a giant hedge fund called OCZIF, which is very present in Guinea. And OCZIF was fined hundreds of millions of dollars by the SEC and the Justice Department for corrupt practices in Africa. Well, the top executives of this fund, they own lavish penthouse apartments overlooking Central Park and estates in the English countryside. One of them bought a 900-acre English estate. And the practical effect of this kind of transfer, in today's world, the poor countries are subsidizing the rich countries, particularly the lifestyles of the CEOs of the multinationals. And the effect of this I saw when I went to Tangier, where I met a Guinean family, a mother and father in their early 20s, who had just given birth to a child, a beautiful little boy. And they told me that they had moved from Guinea because they literally could not make a living in Guinea. The country had been stripped bare by hedge funds like OCZIF. And so they were going to try to make it in Europe, not to steal or to rape or to loot, but to work. And they were going to take that little baby in a lifeboat across the Mediterranean and cross the Strait of Gibraltar to get to Tarifa in Spain. And they were going to drug this little baby so that the baby would stay quiet for 24 hours while they embarked on the crossing and made the crossing. And I begged them not to drug this baby. And then it got me to thinking, like, what would, you know, these parents loved their baby more than their own lives, but they were willing to subject themselves and the baby to this life-threatening situation because Auschwitz had left them no choice, because their country had been stripped bare. So my book has stories of the people who are impacted by these financial outflows and figures on the financial outflows themselves, this corporate colonialism. 40% of multinational profits are immediately moved to tax havens in places like the Cayman Islands and the City of London, where they are beyond the reach of the taxation systems of the countries that they exploit. Every year, $150 billion leaves Africa alone for tax havens. Between 1970 and 2010, Mexico lost $872 billion in illegal financial outflows, and most of it went to corporations doing business in Mexico, to American banks. So in that same time period, that is between 1970 and 2010, 16 million Mexicans came to the United States. They weren't doing anything wrong. They were just following the money, their money.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Suketu Mehta about his book, This Land is Our Land, An Immigrant Manifesto. It's just out in paperback. So you mentioned before the basically how these poor countries are paying for the lifestyles of the rich in the wealthy countries. These are lifestyles that have disproportionately contributed to climate change, the very same climate change that is impacting the countries that we're robbing. And you just mentioned Latin America. You know, there's so much anti-immigrant, we see white nationalism and anti-immigrant fervor in this country. And by the way, you wrote this during, talk about the impact of climate change on the migration or immigration of people from Latin America and Central America.
Your listeners might be familiar with the causes of migration from Central America, particularly the Northern Triangle countries, the fact that they've been beset by civil war and gang violence. Now, many of the civil wars were caused by us, Americans. We've relentlessly interfered in Central American politics. Whenever there's been a democratic alternative or strong trade unions that can challenge the local landlords and generals and despots, we've sent in the Marines. At one point, one American corporation, the United Fruit Company, owned 42% of all the land in Guatemala and tolerated no opposition. We sell them our guns. The vast majority, 3/4 of all the guns in Central America come from the United States. We export our gangs. So MS-13, this dreaded gang that Trump kept bringing up, was created not in Central America, but in the prisons of California. And then we are the biggest market for the product of these gangs, which is drugs. But maybe an even bigger driver of migration is climate change. The coffee harvest in Central America has been failing. There have been regular droughts or floods, climate conditions which they have no control over. And who caused this? We Americans are 4% of the world's population, but we put 1/3 of the excess carbon in the atmosphere. Europe, another 1/3. Americans are the world's biggest carbon polluters. And during the Trump administration, we were the only country to walk away from the Paris Accords. Trump believed that climate change was a Chinese-made hoax. But the U.S. military alone emits more greenhouse gases than 140 countries. The average American uses as much energy as 35 Indians or 185 Ethiopians. So the effects of climate change aren't felt equally across the globe. So the poorest half of the world's population have created just 10% of carbon emissions. But developing countries will bear 75% of the costs of the climate crisis. There was a landmark study that came out of Stanford that shows that since 1960, global warming has reduced the size of India's economy by a third. But it actually increased the GDP of coal countries like Norway and Sweden by 10%. Why? Because the Arctic is now more open to mining and agriculture as the snows melt. So the effects of climate change are felt unequally across the planet. And if I were a farmer in Mali or Guatemala and my crops were withering on the ground and I were, you know, my kids couldn't go to school, I too would pick up and move wherever I could. And right now, the safe havens, the places which are most able to deal with climate change, even though we have our periodic floods and hurricanes, are the rich countries. So in terms of climate migration, you ain't seen nothing yet. By the middle of the century, the UN estimates that around 1 billion people will be displaced by climate change. Large parts of Africa and South Asia will be literally uninhabitable. A human being will not be able to step outside in Delhi or Karachi without roasting to death. So all these people are going to move, and no wall, no border, no armies shooting at them are going to keep these desperate hordes from going to the countries that caused the problem in the first place.
So we have talked about colonialism, corporate colonialism, climate change. You write, before you ask other people to respect the borders of the West, ask yourself if the West has ever respected anybody else's border. Let's talk about war. I mean, that's not the only way that the West has not respected borders, but it is a very major way that continues to happen. So talk about war and particularly, you know, the cost in the Middle East and, you know, in the places on the planet, India and Pakistan, all places that really could be the trigger to nuclear annihilation.
So the U.S.-funded war in El Salvador cost 75,000 lives. I submit that 75,000 people from El Salvador should now get green cards to come live in the U.S. The illegal and highly unnecessary war in Iraq that we perpetrated by lying to the world cost at least 600,000 Iraqi lives. If there was any justice, 600,000 Iraqis today should be given green cards to live in the United States. When it comes to wars, you know, in Africa, in South Asia, we have to go back and look at colonialism. Just two countries, Britain and France, created 40% of all the borders that exist in the world today. When the British left in 1947, they departed in haste because after the Second World War, it just wasn't profitable to keep exploiting India. So they took off and they gave a barrister named Sir Cyril Radcliffe, who had never been to India, knew nothing about India. They shipped him to India and gave him 5 weeks to draw two lines down a map, two lines which now constitute the borders of India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, home to almost 2 billion people. And I've gone to those borders. I've interviewed people who were alive in 1947 on both sides of those lines, and they fell on each other. There was a biggest program of ethnic cleansing because people didn't know, Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, didn't know which side of Radcliffe's lines they were going to be in 5 weeks. And so communities pushed out their minority populations. It was the biggest mass migration in history. Millions of people moved. About 1 million people died. More than 1 million women were raped. And this happened because the British were in such a desperate hurry to leave. So it wasn't just what happened when the colonizers ruled these countries. It's how they left. You know, we keep looking at all these tribal wars in Africa, and some of the details are horrific. You know, these child soldiers and this unending war and conflict between tribes, and we can't make sense of it. Look at a map of Africa. It abounds in straight lines, and they were made by the colonizers, by the English, the French, the Germans, the Portuguese. So, you know, these lines go through tribal nations that existed for centuries before the colonizers got there. So the biggest cause of civil wars in Africa is colonial mapmaking, and it continues to the present day. Colonialism has consequences. And in the histories that we read, if you look at British textbooks, the empire is almost absent. If you look at British media, it abounds in television and film adaptations of novels like Jewel in the Crown or Passage to India, which paint colonialism this sepia-tinged haze. And both of these narratives center around the rape of an English woman by an Indian man, when in fact the reality was there was mass rape of Indian women by English colonial officers. But the narrative always is, when it comes to mainstream mass media, the British and the French and, you know, the European colonial regimes in general have a kind of historical amnesia about it. They would prefer to forget. And they are reminded constantly by the waves of immigrants that come to their shores.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with Suketu Mehta about his immigrant manifesto, as he calls it, This Land is Our Land. And we also do want to let our listeners know that you, the way you write this book is so many stories are interwoven with it, along with this really concise but comprehensive treatment of how the pieces fit together to come up with, you know, the situation we face today, which is a situation of mass migration, as you say, is going to be the feature of the 21st century, and the rise of authoritarian and nationalist movements against it, which is, you know, terrifying in itself. But before we get to that second part, you also write about immigrants as heroes. And it is really so, it was so powerful. Why do you call immigrants heroes?
If you want to make the world a better place, the best way is to let people from the poor countries come to the rich countries, because they will send money back home. Most people move not just to better themselves, but to better their families who they leave behind and they miss so much. Remittances are the single best way to help people in the developing countries. Migrants last year sent back over $700 billion in remittances, which amounts to 3 times more than the direct gains from abolishing all trade barriers, 4 times more than all the foreign aid on the planet combined, and 100 times the amount of all debt relief. So people move and they send back money. But I saw this firsthand when I went to the U.S.-Mexico border south of San Diego. There's a place called Friendship Park, which was established during the Nixon administration. So it was a patch of ground right by the Pacific Ocean, above Tijuana and below San Diego, where if you were on this side of the border and you missed your family, they could come up and you could sit down with them and, you know, have a picnic and give them a hug. And then they would go back to Mexico and you would go back to the U.S. And it didn't matter if you didn't have papers or if you were just here on a work authorization. This was a place, the only place along the entire southern border where you could meet your family. So this continued under successive administrations, including the Clinton and Obama administrations. More and more restrictions began to be put up. A fence came up, so you could no longer hug your family, but you could, you know, shake their hands. And under the Trump administration, when I visited Friendship Park in 2018, there's this thick, ugly, industrial mesh fence of rusted iron where you could still see your family face to face, but you could only do it on weekends for 10 minutes at a time. So I stayed there for around 2 weeks, and it was the most emotional reporting of my career. I saw, for example, a Mexican man who was a construction worker. And he had left Mexico 17 years ago because his mom was sick and he couldn't make a living in Mexico to pay her hospital bills. So he left everything he knew, all his family, and moved north and worked in Colorado in construction, working brutally hard 7 days a week, and sent all the money that he saved back to his family. And he would talk to her sometimes using phone cards and then see her on Skype. But he wanted to see her, and his mom particularly wanted to see him face to face. So finally, he heard about Friendship Park, and I encountered him as he came up to the fence, and he was going to see his mom the first time in 17 years. And he goes up to the fence, and his mom, who had come from a distant region of Mexico, came up to the fence on the other side, and they put their faces up on either side of this iron fence. And he told me later, he could hear his mom, he could feel her breath upon his face. And she said, "I missed you, my son." And he said, "I love you, Mama." And she said, "You look too thin. You don't look like you're eating right." It's the universal thing all moms say to their sons. And he puts up his hands to the fence, and the holes in the fence are only large enough to allow your pinky finger to go through. So his mom puts up her hands and her pinky goes through the hole and his pinky goes through the hole and their pinkies touch. And all along the fence, there were mothers and sons, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, best friends, doing the slightest bit of touching. They call it the pinky kiss. These were heroes, people like this construction worker who've come here not to rob and to, or to rape or loot or all of the things that Trump and the nativists denigrate them with. They're not criminals. They're heroes. They've come here to work, to build a better America, and to send money back to their mothers for their hospital treatment, for their sisters to get educated.
Suketu Mehta. We'll talk more with him about This Land Is Our Land after the break. Don't go away. Johnny Cash singing Woody Guthrie's song, This Land Was Made for You and Me. And welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Let's continue our conversation with Suketu Mehta about his immigrant's manifesto, This Land Is Our Land. So let's talk about now. You wrote this book during the Trump years. Trump made immigration the center of his policy of hate, of building hate. But you really, in this book, Suketu Mehta, in This Land Is Our Land, you show that immigrants not only do not take away our jobs, but they actually improve the economies of the countries that they come to. So tell us, why do immigrants not take away native jobs, and how do they impact our economies?
All over the world, there are these populists like Trump, like Boris Johnson, like Orban in Hungary, and Putin and Modi. And many of these populists in the West particularly have risen to power through demagoguery, through this stoking of these fears of immigrants. I believe the biggest factor in Trump's rise was his promise to build a wall, invoking these immigrant armadas and these caravans full of immigrants who were coming here to steal and rob and rape. And the greatest damage in these countries were caused not by immigrants, but by fear of immigrants. I mean, look at Britain. It's fear of immigrants that led to Brexit, the biggest own goal in British history. Look at the pathetic condition of England after Brexit. So in my book, I've got reams of evidence that immigrants improve the countries that they come to. They create jobs, they commit crimes at a lower rate, and today's immigrants assimilate at faster rates than earlier generations of immigrants. Without immigration, America's economic growth would have been 15% lower in recent years. Britain's would have been 20% lower, and Southern Europe's would have been 30% lower. If we were to deport all 12 million undocumented immigrants in this country, the economy would lose $8 trillion over the next 14 years. However, if we were to legalize all of them, the economy would gain $2 trillion in that same time period. We immigrants are 14% of the American population, but we started a quarter of all new businesses, and we've earned a third of all the science Nobel Prizes given to Americans. One in four U.S. tech companies established in recent times have had an immigrant founder. Three quarters of Silicon Valley tech workers are immigrants. The immigrant armada that is coming to our shores is actually a rescue fleet. And that's because we, like most of the rich countries, are aging. Half of all Americans are over the age of 40. Most immigrants don't come here with their parents, so the Social Security taxes go towards paying for other people's parents. Social Security is the biggest place where immigrants make a contribution. In 1960, there were five workers paying Social Security taxes for every person who retired or was disabled. By 2013, there were fewer than three. So there's a shrinking pool of workers paying into the Social Security system. And starting next year, the Social Security Administration will spend more money than it collects. By 2035, it'll be bankrupt. And you'll only get 80% of the benefits that you're entitled to. And the only thing that can save Social Security is greater migration. Because immigrants, both legal and illegal, will contribute $500 billion into the Social Security Trust Fund over the next 25 years. And this is even more dramatic in the case of undocumented immigrants, because the undocumented pay into the system but are ineligible for most benefits. In 2010, undocumented migrants paid $13 billion in taxes, but received only $1 billion in benefits. So $12 billion went towards subsidizing the rest of us.
Yeah, I just want to point out, your figures are correct if we do nothing to fix the Social Security system, you know, which is being talked about now in terms of raising the abysmally low cap on Social Security taxes. But the point is well taken. And another point, I mean, you call them populists, but they're really not populists. There's nothing in the interests of the people that Orban or Trump, I mean, they put in the most plutocratic kinds of administrations imaginable. This is really a kind of fake populism. But what's important to talk about also is how this fear of immigrants prevents people from voting for things that would help everybody.
That's right. So I live in New York and in a small town in rural North Carolina where I go to write. And the majority of my neighbors voted for Trump in the last election. And North Carolina, in fact, went for Trump and elected a Republican senator. And so I've been having conversations with my neighbors about what it is that they like about this man. And many of them who don't like Trump personally are somehow swayed by what he says about immigrants. That is, the fears that he evokes about migrants speak to something in them. Now, Steve Bannon and I agree about almost nothing, but we do agree about this one thing where he once said that the origins of today's populists are in the 2008 financial crisis. And in that crisis, the banks sold people houses that they couldn't afford, and the whole thing came crashing down. And the federal government bailed out the bankers, and the bankers, well, they laughed literally all the way to the bank, and they became richer than ever. So global inequality today is higher than ever, six men today own more wealth than half of all human beings on the planet combined, more than 3.5 billion people. So I've traveled to places for my book. I went to factory towns in Pennsylvania. I went to East Germany, or the former East Germany. I went to depressed white working class places around the world. And I saw what was happening. These people too had their futures stolen. And so they were very vulnerable to people like Trump or Orban or Nigel Farage, who told them that their futures were stolen not by the bankers, but by the newest, the weakest, the migrants. Hannah Arendt calls it the alliance of the mob and capital. She was referring to Weimar Germany, where the Nazis too were effective in stoking popular outrage around reparations paid after World War I and the Great Depression, stoking this rage not against the aristocracy or the rich in Germany, but against the Jews, who were the visible face of capitalism. And so we're seeing a return of this kind of populism in today's times. And the immigrants are the easiest target. So I don't entirely blame the white working classes. I see why they are angry. But the elites in this country, they're no fools. They know that the peasants will come for them with pitchforks unless this outrage is diverted. So much of the fear and the hatred of migrants isn't organic. It's not that, all these white people were born hateful. They were taught to fear and hate. There's a deliberate astroturfing of these groups to turn rage away from the legitimate targets of this rage and on to Muslims and Mexicans, for example.
So now we have a new administration. One of the first things that Biden did was say that he was going to prevent deportations at the border, put them off for 100 days, although unfortunately that's already been violated. But, he does talk about creating a pathway to citizenship, finally. Do you see reason for hope with the Biden administration? And what should we be looking out for? What will tell us that his administration is serious about dealing with it? What would you tell him that needs to happen to tackle the issue head on?
So I am hopeful about the Biden administration. I think they have some good policies. But, in the end, my book isn't about why it benefits America or Europe to let in more migrants. I do make a very strong case that it does. But I just want to turn the tables a little bit. The whole debate around global migration is, what's in it for the rich countries? How many migrants? Should we let in immigrants or not? If so, how many? And if so, with what level of skills? What I want to ask is, why are these people moving in it for the first place? They're sometimes referred to as the push factors. And to his credit, Biden has mentioned that he wants to look at the root causes, why people are leaving Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, to come to the U.S. What is it that's made life so desperate in these countries? And how can we help people stay down on the farm? And I think that really needs to be addressed before we talk about our quotas. And if these rich countries do have quotas, they should be based on how much we've despoiled the countries that they've come from. So England should have quotas for Nigerians and Indians. The US should have quotas for Dominicans and Guatemalans. France should have quotas for Haitians. So in a way, I'm talking about immigration as reparations. There's a debt that needs to be paid. But we should be glad to pay it, because when immigrants come, as my book demonstrates, they make our countries better. And we need them, because we're still, most of the West still has lots and lots of space. America is not full, is one thing I would say to Biden. The U.S. ranks 191st of all the countries in the world for density. We're among the emptiest countries on the planet, with 86 people per square mile. 80% of the U.S. population lives in only 3% of the continent. U.S. population growth is the slowest since the Great Depression. And we're aging. From 2015 to 2050, the number of Americans aged 85 and older will increase by more than 200%, while the number of Americans younger than 65 will increase only by 12%. So we're aging and we need more young people, and immigrants tend to be younger and work harder. And in terms of skilled immigrants, in the 21st century, there's going to be a global race for talent. Canada, for example, has announced its intention to increase its immigration intake threefold. It's a big, empty country. It needs warm bodies for a cold country. And so it aggressively goes out and recruits skilled migrants from around the globe. So what I would say is, you know, it's a battle of narratives. The economic evidence is very, very strong, almost undeniable. There are ways to intelligently manage influxes of migrants. And to be clear, I'm not calling for open borders. I'm calling for open hearts. I'm asking you to put yourself in the shoes of these migrant mothers who are willing to cross deserts and oceans to do what all of us want, give their children a better life.
Well, Suketu Mehta, your book is such a huge step forward in the understanding of that point of view, one that I think we all really do need to take to heart. This Land is Our Land, an Immigrant Manifesto. And thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Suketu Mehta. Read an excerpt from This Land is Our Land at writersvoice.net. Next up, false solutions to green energy. As you've heard time and again on this program, we need to transition to a green energy economy as fast as possible in order to keep the climate within habitable limits. As the transition gets underway, however, there are voices touting solutions that my next guest says are masquerading as green, but are anything but. Lou Daly wrote the report False Solutions for New York Renews. That's a coalition of over 200 grassroots environmental and labor groups instrumental in getting New York State to pass its landmark climate law at the end of 2019. But as the planning to implement that law takes place, fossil fuel interests are pushing forms of energy that Daly calls false solutions in his report of that name. Here's an abridged version of that interview. Lou Daly, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So New York's climate law mandates certain strong, robust emissions targets, emissions reductions targets. But the devil is in the detail. And this report, False Solutions, examines a particular set of false solutions to the climate crisis, as it claims, some of which literally add more greenhouse gas emissions than they reduce. So before we get into talking about the actual false solutions, who is pushing these policies?
Well, I think what we're seeing is, and this is particularly prevalent with the gas industry, which many of your listeners know has a very large footprint in downstate New York as well as upstate, but across the state is about 40% of our electricity, a large portion of home heating as well. And so several of the false solutions take the form of biogas, which is being touted as cleaner or greener than fossil gas, but is, first of all, is not. And we'll get into these questions of the so-called carbon neutrality of this sort of bioenergy. But also very plainly, if you read the corporate documents of, say, National Grid, they view these cleaner forms of gas as a way of greening their gas delivery system and infrastructure in order to perpetuate it and lock it in as part of the energy mix of New York State, even as you mentioned, the CLCPA is requiring a complete transition off of fossil fuels by 2050.
So let's go into some of these false solutions. First of all, biofuels. What are biofuels and what is the false solution that they pose?
So biofuels are typically categorized as a liquid biofuels for transportation. And in all of these cases, except for hydrogen, what we are talking about here is essentially fuels produced from organic matter. So broadly categorized as, quote, biomass, meaning feedstocks of organic matter that are processed to create fuels. Biofuels, as a category, as I mentioned, are liquid fuels for transportation. And most prevalently, people see at the gas pump, ethanol is by far the, you know, the largest production of biofuels, and that is derived from corn. It's a corn alcohol, and it is about 38% or 40% of our corn production is diverted for producing ethanol for the fuel system. So I would point to biofuels here as a very good example of the claim that bioenergy is carbon neutral really not being true. These aren't carbon neutral if you account for them on a life cycle basis, like the whole chain of production from growing the feedstocks to harvesting them to processing them to transporting them. And then if you also include land use issues, especially indirect land use issues, which happen when you take land away from food to grow feedstocks for biofuels, then you're causing indirect land use changes that cause emissions. And so this disrupts the carbon cycle, and it has a carbon neutrality gap, is what they call it, whereby producing the fuels, it takes anywhere from 50 to 150 years to actually recycle the emissions from those fuels back into the biosphere. So it is not carbon neutral. It's on a very different timeline compared, for example, to the tipping points of the climate crisis recommended by the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change.
So in other words, does that mean that the emissions that are created by burning this biofuel happen now, but the emissions taken out of the atmosphere by the growing process takes a lot longer?
Yes, and there's a particularly potent example of that in the case of burning wood, which I think we'll get to. But I do think, as a general kind of conceptual point, and this is significant not just because it's sort of an academic argument, but this theory is built into the protocols of the IPCC itself in terms of what is renewable, what is carbon neutral. It's built into EU protocols. It's built into the US protocols, although the EPA is starting to make some changes in this respect. The fundamental problem is that to theorize or to hypothesize that burning wood or creating fuels from corn or other organic livestock is carbon neutral, the idea is that even though you're putting similar amount of emissions into the atmosphere, those emissions are inherently offset by the carbon stored in the feedstocks that you're using to produce the fuels. The problem with that is something that in accounting is called the fallacy of double counting, because that stored carbon is already stored in those feedstocks. And so when you release new emissions on top of that existing cycle, you're adding emissions on top of the carbon cycle. And so the only way to really, to truly neutralize the emissions that you're putting into the atmosphere immediately is to add carbon storage equal to those emissions. And that is decidedly not happening. In fact, the opposite is happening. We're putting more land into use for fuels and disrupting carbon storage.
And we are talking with Lou Daly of New Yorker News about the report that he wrote, False Solutions. You know, this is such an interesting report. And Let's go on to renewable natural gas, because I have been listening from time to time to the Climate Action Council, that is the group that was brought together in order to create a scoping plan to implement the CLCPA. And I have seen in some of those meetings that they've had the mention of renewable natural gas, which immediately pricked my interest and suspicion. What is renewable natural gas, and why is that part of the planning for the CLCPA?
Yeah, it's a very malleable concept of renewable. So essentially, it is biogas that is derived from waste streams, like landfills or manure. And I guess it's considered renewable because it's assumed we will always have these waste streams to manage, and maybe that is true. But I think it's also touted as green because it's true that a landfill or a livestock operation through what's called anaerobic digestion will release methane primarily into the atmosphere on its own. And so the way you green those waste streams is by capturing the methane, preventing them from going into the atmosphere, and in one way or another using it. The problem is that the industry wants to scale biogas harvesting to be able to blend into their delivery system in ways that aren't simply limited to local uses, where you capture the methane and then you use it on site for heating, for example. Rather, they want to process the methane that they capture from these waste streams. They want to put it into the gas delivery system, where anywhere from 3 to 5% of it will be leaked into the atmosphere, just like is the case with fossil gas. And then at the end use, there's further methane leakage at the distribution points with the fittings where the gas is being delivered to households. And so you're just adding to the methane leakage problem that already exists with fossil gas, which your listeners probably know is a very significant contributor to climate change.
Yeah, some 70 times more potent to greenhouse gas and carbon dioxide, although less long-lasting. So let's go on to, you mentioned before, hydrogen, so-called green hydrogen. What is the false solution there?
Well, hydrogen, and I do want to say about hydrogen that there are potentially some beneficial limited uses to hydrogen that I will want to circle back to. So hydrogen doesn't quite fit in the bioenergy paradigm, although you can derive hydrogen from gasifying organic matter. But primarily hydrogen today is derived from methane, from heating up methane. In other words, it's derived from fossil fuels. And you precipitate the hydrogen by a thermochemical process from the methane. Methane being CH4 for molecules of hydrogen. And it's primarily deployed for industrial uses like heat processes for producing ammonia, steel, other industrial products. And the idea of hydrogen being a cleaner fuel, because otherwise those industries would have to use fossil heat. Electricity is not hot enough for these industrial processes. The idea is that if you put in hydrogen, which doesn't contain greenhouse gases, that's a cleaner form of the industrial process. The problem is on the production side of the hydrogen, which is highly carbon intensive. And so on net, you're really actually creating more greenhouse gases than you're reducing by putting the hydrogen into the industrial process, because you're producing it from fossil fuels. Now, what green hydrogen is a proposal to use renewable electricity to do electrolysis of water, because of course, H2O, you can precipitate hydrogen from water. And so that is green, at least a sense of greener, at least ostensibly in terms of the production process. The problem that we really strongly identify in the report is that on any kind of scale of hydrogen production, and there's a very interesting McKinsey report that was put out by the fossil fuel industries last fall suggesting the pathway to a very large-scale hydrogen economy, so they're not thinking about this in terms of small uses. What happens is that you're diverting a lot of renewable electricity to produce another form of energy instead of to power cars, to power buildings, to electrify all the sectors economy-wide, which is the idea of the CLCPA. And so I think that this will destabilize and throw off our trajectory toward 100% zero emissions because you're diverting energy that we already have generated for electricity to create yet another form of energy.
But wouldn't the advantage would be, I mean, the issue is storage, you know, the other forms of renewable energy, wind and solar, you know, have a storage problem. Because you can't store electricity, but you would be able to store hydrogen. So talk about some of the beneficial uses for hydrogen. How do we separate the wheat from the chaff, so to speak?
Yeah, I would just add one additional problem, which has not been much commented upon. But if you're talking about producing hydrogen from water, you're also using a lot of water to generate energy. And in some parts of the country, some research suggests that could cause severe water stress. So on the beneficial uses, for sure, I think hydrogen fuel cells as a storage infrastructure for managing load of the renewable energy system, particularly as we're expanding the supply of renewable electricity, if we're talking about electrifying transportation and buildings, could be a very beneficial use for hydrogen cells. So in other words, the energy can be stored in the hydrogen fuel cells when there is an excess of energy, like in the summer, and then can be dispatched through this hydrogen fuel cell infrastructure when there is an excess of demand for energy, for example, during the winter, especially in the colder parts of the country. So that is a beneficial use, to be sure. But if you look at the industry planning around hydrogen, it goes way beyond electricity, renewable electricity storage. It's about heating buildings and really competing with battery electric vehicles to take a large share of the transportation fuel market.
And Lou Daly, in this report, False Solutions, the final one we'll talk about here in any event is waste to energy. I remember meeting somebody, a Swedish sustainability director for a town, and she proudly told me that the entire town ran on waste energy, but you call it a cure worse than the disease.
Waste to energy. A little bit of background. We have 10 waste to energy plants left in New York State, four of which are on Long Island. These are garbage burning steam plants where you're dealing with a waste management problem, that is excess waste, by burning it. This is what we mean by the cure is worse than the disease, particularly from a greenhouse gas perspective and a local emissions perspective. And so it doesn't make sense to me. And I think the trajectory of waste to energy is definitely downward. A lot of the plants, I think there are maybe 70 across the country that are left, are nearing the end of their commissions. And you know, we'll see in the next couple of years with the Biden clean energy plan, like where waste to energy lands. But I'll say two things about it. The first is that from an environmental justice perspective, generating power from burning garbage is worse than generating power from burning fossil fuels. And this is especially true when it comes to hazardous air pollutants. A study done by Yale health experts for New York Renews compared our waste to energy emissions in New York State to power sector emissions from fossil fuels and found substantial increases in hazardous air pollutants, which are the cancer-causing air pollutants, although slightly better on particulate matter compared to, say, burning coal. But on net, I think worse from an environmental justice perspective. And two, it is simply a crutch for not really dealing with our waste, our excess waste problem in more productive ways, such as reducing waste in the production of these goods. Much better recycling. Our recycling rate in New York City is pathetic. It's like 18% of recyclable goods are recycled.
What are the true solutions? I mean, it almost seems as if every move forward could involve a move backward. We've got to get to zero emissions by 2035 or at the latest 2050. What can we do to achieve that goal?
Well, if you start with New York State's Clean Energy Standard, which has now been revised to meet the emissions targets of the CLCPA, in Tier 1 of the Clean Energy Standard, you know, there is a clear definition of renewable energy as wind, solar, geothermal, hydro, not including bioenergy. So we can start there and we can really think about what level of investment is needed to really build out new renewable energy in New York State. And some researchers are convinced that that would be feasible, particularly with the kind of energy storage infrastructure that you referred to. In which case, limited production of hydrogen for hydrogen fuel cells would be a good idea. So that is part of the solution, but as a storage component, not as a direct source of energy. Energy efficiency, when I first started in climate work, they were talking about a third, getting to a third of the emissions reductions we need through energy efficiency, through saving energy. And, you know, we have the local law 97 in New York City, which really tackles building emissions through efficiency mandates and clean energy mandates in New York City, which is a big deal because building emissions is about 70% of our greenhouse gas footprint here in New York. And then with transportation, you know, incentives, financing to fully electrify all of our vehicle fleets, perhaps with the exception of heavy duty trucking, which may require some form of bioenergy, is, you know, a clear pathway. It will just take a lot of money to build that out. And so a lot of this, I think, is about investment. We know what the right solutions are. We need the level of investment and regulatory incentive to get there.
That was Lew Daly. Go to writersvoice.net to find a link to his report, False Solutions. And you can also find the extended version of that interview. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.